organizing informational rallies. We need to be talking in every workplace. We need to get union members and their allies out on picket lines and in marches and holding hearings and town halls about this attack on working people. And when we organize like that, we learn how to stick together, and we can actually consider something like striking, political striking, to fight this right to work Friedrich decision that's coming in June. The Supreme Court was influenced by the strike wave of the 1970s. By 1975, all that whole period of time, so in the early 70s, public sector workers were striking illegally, and were functioning without a fair share, without fair share, without agency shop, without being able to collect dues from everybody. The Supreme Court was influenced by this strike wave, which by 1975 is when the Abode decision came down. So the Supreme Court is impacted by what happens in society, and the way that the labor movement is either mobilized or demobilized. So certainly we have to organize to fight the elections. The problem with the ballot initiatives coming our way in the state of Oregon, but we also need to mobilize to fight this Supreme Court decision.
Thank you, Jamie. This is Labor Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. In October, I spoke with CNN contributor and author Van Jones. Senate Bill 2123, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, had just passed the Senate Judiciary Committee. The same day, 130 top police chiefs and prosecutors from all 50 states called for the reduction in unnecessary arrests, prosecutions, and incarceration. Van Jones believes this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to end the United States mass incarceration.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
It is my honor to have as my guest Van Jones. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
I'm happy to be here. It's an honor for me.
So, Van Jones, you are co-founder of Cut 50, a national bipartisan initiative to safely and smartly reduce our incarcerated population by 50% over the next 10 years. How do you plan to cut the prison population by half over the next 10 years?
Well, one step at a time is probably the best way to think about it. We are in a very rare moment where there is no controversy about the need for reform. In fact, the President of the United States went and visited a federal prison, the first time that's ever happened with a sitting president. When he came out, he didn't come out and say, well, the people in prison, you know, you do the crime, do your time. Hey, kids, this is going to happen to you if you aren't careful. He comes out and says, hey, listen, I did the same stuff these guys did, and but for the grace of God and some good support, I'd be in here with them. Well, that was shocking. And then not one Republican of any significance in the country attacked him for doing that or making the statement. In fact, the same day, then-Speaker Boehner came out and called for a bipartisan vote on criminal justice reform in Washington, D.C. That was inconceivable even 2 years ago, that a black president could go into a prison, sit down and meet with black and brown convicted folks and then come out and blame the system, not blame them, and no Republican attack him for being a hug a thug president, which is what would have happened even 2 years ago. So we have a rare moment, at least in terms of the public awareness. The challenge that we have is to start passing laws that will begin to roll the mass incarceration industry back. That will be accomplished one step at a time. There's legislation in Congress right now, inadequate though it is, to at least begin to shrink some of these mandatory minimums and begin to deal with some of the reentry challenges at the federal level. That will be the first bill. And then my expectation is there will be many, many more at state levels, at local levels, tribal and federal government. And over time, we should be able to shrink the prison population back to somewhat reasonable numbers. Even going from 2.3 million to 1.1 million is still probably four times too big. But these things do take time to correct.
Do you see this happening in the next 10 years?
Absolutely. You know, there will be some pushback and there will be some fight back. But the Republicans themselves, I'm a strong Democrat, but Republicans themselves are saying three things. One is that the prison system has become a big, failed, unaccountable government bureaucracy that sucks up a lot of money and produces terrible results. So just the limited government fiscal conservatives want to see real changes. Number two, the libertarians see mass incarceration and the growth of this incarceration industry as a real threat to liberty overall. So they put the drug war in with the NSA and everything else and say they've got concerns. And then even the social conservative Christian evangelicals, with whom I disagree on the question of marriage and with whom I disagree on the question of women's right to choose, I agree with them when they say that every soul matters in the eyes of the Creator, and how can we treat people this way and then give them no pathway to redemption? You leave a physical prison and you then are in an economic prison for the rest of your life, labeled a felon, not able to vote in many places, not able to get a job in many places, not able to get even an apartment or a student loan. And where is the redemption there? So all three legs of the Republican domestic policy coalition, the fiscal conservatives, the libertarians, and the Christian evangelicals all agree that change is required. Will the prosecutors and the private prisons and the other people with a financial and power interest in the status quo push back? Will they use scary tactics and fear-mongering? Yes, they will. But I think that the momentum has gone to the other side now, to our side, and it's a question of us being smart enough to push for the best deals that we can legislatively, make sure that we get the legislation that we can get, but also continue to push for humanization in the public discourse so that we can continue the process moving forward.
And let's talk about some of the national legislation. Senate Bill 2123, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, it just passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it may be headed to the Senate floor for a full vote. Now, Cut 50 wants to improve this legislation. Let's talk a little bit about some of the areas that Cut 50, your organization, is looking at improving. First of all, you want to lessen the use and abuse of mandatory minimums. Van Jones, we're talking about legislation on the national level. On the national level, in the federal prison system, you're talking about three strikes, you're out. Here in Oregon, we have a mandatory minimum sentencing law called Measure 11. It is a one strike, you're out law. Our legislators are fearful of appearing soft on crime, so they will not reform these mandatory minimums, and our district attorneys, our prosecutors at the local level, are in love with these mandatory minimum sentencing laws, and reform organizations have exhausted all efforts. How will this legislation, this national legislation, affect a state such as Oregon, a progressive state? How do you see this changing these sentencing laws here in Oregon?
Well, first of all, I think you're in a very different posture when you cut on the television and you see the President of the United States possibly in the Rose Garden, possibly in the East Wing, surrounded by Republican legislators about to sign a bill that will begin to make major change. And in the front row, you see law enforcement as 130 law enforcement leaders, including people who run the biggest jails in America, came out and said they want sentencing reform. They want criminal justice reform. And when you see the President of the United States and you see Republicans and you see law enforcement officials and you see formerly incarcerated people all on one accord at the very, very top of our society, I think that changes a dynamic at the state, local, and tribal levels where people can say, listen, I'm in agreement with the Republican majority in Congress. Certainly no softy liberals there. I'm in agreement with the President of the United States. I'm in agreement with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that we have right now is that there's a consensus out there that the light has not been cut on for. And instead, the people who continue to grab the spotlight and to grab the megaphone are these people with a status quo interest in the broken present system. So, for instance, you now have an entire generation of prosecutors who have come of age in a time when they have only had these super weapons to aim at American citizens. They've not gone to trial. They say, listen, I'm going to give you 90 years or you can plead and I'll give you 15.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten to a point where people think like 15 years in prison for a nonviolent offense for being addicted to some substance is a good deal because with all these mandatory minimums, the prosecutors have all the power at the level of charging. The judges' hands are tied. The judges are not allowed to judge. They just have to rubber stamp whatever the prosecutor puts on paper. And people are afraid to go to trial because of a possible negative outcome. So you now, they could pass a lie detector test. These prosecutors honestly believe that there's no other way to run the system, and that if they don't have these massive powers and if they don't have the system completely out of balance, where judges can't judge and defense attorneys can't defend and trials never happen, that it's going to be Armageddon. They believe that. But we happen to know of, you know, the 100, almost 200 years of American jurisprudence before we gave all these weapons to these prosecutors, that you can actually have a justice system that's a little bit more just when judges can judge, when prosecutors, you know, have to make their case, and defendants aren't so terrified that sometimes they are willing to face a jury of their peers. So part of it is recognizing that these prosecutors are speaking for themselves, for their own power and their own laziness. They're not speaking for the American system the way that it was designed. It never worked perfectly, but certainly worked better than this. The other thing I would say is that we have to start talking about the fact that that drug prohibition, and I'm somebody who's never used drugs and don't want my children using drugs. I'm anti-drug, but I'm against the drug war because you have a situation now where the prohibition of drugs has created a massive, violent black market. And the best friend of the drug cartels now are the people who continue to insist that all of these drugs be classified illegal, and that anybody who gets caught using them should go away to prison for a long time. All that does is give the drug cartels more power because it gives them a bigger black market, and people who are addicted are the fodder both for the incarceration industry and the pawns of these drug cartels, and the two are starting essentially to work together in terms of the impact that they're having. They're reinforcing each other, not working together, but they're reinforcing each other in terms of the impact that they're having on the negative impact on communities that are vulnerable. And you have to begin to call these people out. You know, why are you helping these drug cartels maintain these black markets that are creating so much violence? Why won't you reform these laws so we treat people who are addicted as having a health issue, where we begin to ratchet down on these long sentences, use our money in a more wise way to make safer communities, and the only people standing in the way are people who are making tons of money as prison profiteers, who have tons of status as prosecutors on steroids, and neither of their interests are more important than the interests of our country in the interest of our children, in the interest of our communities. And you have to come just like that.
And Van Jones, one of Cut 50's ways of improving this Senate bill is to create alternatives to prison for those where drug treatment and mental health care are better alternatives. What alternatives do you see? And in your travels around the country, what programs are working?
Well, I mean, pretty much anything at this point would work better than what we're doing. You're spending $50,000, $80,000 a year to lock people up, and then when they come home, they don't have a job, and they're no better off emotionally. They're worse off emotionally, no better off in terms of their education. So pretty much at this point, anything, you could literally just pay people not to commit crimes, and you get a better outcome. You say, look, here's the deal. You know, here's $50,000. Just don't commit any crimes. And I mean, any system that you came up with would be better than the one that we have right now, which feeds more crime than it prevents. But there are all kinds of wonderful programs, drug courts and veterans courts and others, that are problem-solving courts. The whole point is that the judge gets to judge, that you get a chance to really look at the person as an individual. You're trying to figure out how to, as quickly as possible, get the person back on a good pathway, as opposed to this false notion that if you just, you know, throw enough horribly long sentences at enough people, everybody else is somehow going to, you know, never touch drugs again. I mean, that's the flawed premise of the drug war, is that if you lock up enough people, you can get people who want to sell drugs off the street, and you can scare everybody else into not doing drugs. And you got more people doing drugs now than you did when the thing started. So I'm a big fan of alternatives to incarceration. I'm a big fan of the mental health courts and veteran courts and drug courts and other things. Some are better than others. Pretty much anything would be better than what we're doing right now.
And we are doing a lot around reentry here in Oregon. But one thing we do find is that programs inside prison as well as in the community, they begin, we get funding for them, but they're unsustainable. The funding ends, the programs end. How do you see sustaining programs that actually work?
Well, I mean, part of it is that there should be more accountability for the programs that never run out of money. The prisons never run out of money, but there's no accountability. Why shouldn't it be the case that just like they want teachers to be held accountable for the performance of their students, why not have wardens be held accountable for the performance of the people that they've had in their custody for 2, 3, 5, 20 years? You have somebody in your custody for 10 years, and you send them home, and they have no job skills, and their education is not any better, their mental health is not any better. In fact, it's worse. And they wind up back in custody in 6 months. Why shouldn't the warden be fired? Why shouldn't the warden be replaced? Why are the programs that fail us over and over again absolutely secure in their funding? And then those programs that do a good job or have to, you know, beg year to year and can be cut off at any time. So part of it has to do with trying to transform the entire paradigm of these big, massive monuments to racism and cynicism called prisons, and to say, listen, why don't we align the financial incentives? Why don't we say to a warden, if you have people in your custody and you find cost-effective ways to turn them around, whether it's yoga or meditation or teaching basic literacy or conflict resolution or teaching a trade or whatever it is, and those folks leave and you work hard to make sure they wind up employed, and if you can't find employers for them, you make your own contracting for the prison, pro-friendly environment for formerly incarcerated people. You do whatever you can, use every tool in your toolbox, and then you get people not coming back home, you'll get more money. See, nobody gets paid any extra money if people rehabilitate themselves or help to be rehabilitated in prison. Nobody gets an extra dime. If 10 guys leave here Monday morning from a prison and they come back on Friday with their three best friends, the prison gets more money. Nobody gets fired. Mm. We gotta really go a lot deeper. And, say, well, what about competition? What about accountability? Why is it only when we're talking about the incarceration industry that suddenly there's no accountability, there's no results, there's no financial alignment of incentives, there's no alignment of financial incentives? Why are we doing it this way? And then It turns out there's a pretty big pot of money, $80 billion a year spent on incarceration, that money should be opened up for better approaches.
Now, I want to get back to our mandatory minimums, because this is a huge issue here in Oregon. Are we going to hear leaders on the national level calling on the states to reform their mandatory minimums?
Well, some will and some won't. You know, on the national stage, people usually are running for federal office, and so they tend to punt on what the states should and should not do. I think you're going to hear a more general call for better and smarter approaches. There's so much data now that just shows that the mandatory minimums don't work. I mean, whatever it is you want them to do, they don't do it. They don't make people, they don't scare people into not committing crimes. They don't ensure that people who do get caught get any better. And what they are great at doing, though, is sucking a lot of people into the revolving door of prisons. And, we have to keep making the case, but I tell you what, you know, we are in a much better posture than we have been. There are certainly ignorant people and fearmongers and those kind of people who are willing to say anything. But all the data now, after a 20, 30, 40-year experiment, is pointing out more and more, with more and more clarity, that what we're doing right now is not working. And I think what we have to continue to do is to lift up the stories of people whose lives are being wrecked and ruined. You know, people want to do something. One thing you could do is to go to justicereformnow.org. That's justicereformnow.org. I work for an organization called Cut 50. We're working to cut the prison population in half in 10 years, and our main campaign is justicereformnow.org. About 250,000 people have already signed up there to fight against the incarceration industry, including about 91 major celebrities, from Russell Simmons to Alicia Silverstone to Amy Schumer. We're building a grassroots, netroots, nonviolent army across the country to do something about this.
Let's turn to the 2016 presidential election. Hillary Clinton has just agreed to stop accepting direct contributions from private prison lobbyists. What commitments for criminal justice reform should we be expecting from our presidential candidates?
Well, I mean, I think that petty offenses, there should be no mandatory minimums at all. A judge should be able to look at somebody and say, hey, maybe you were pushing what you were doing because of economic desperation or because you're addicted or because your boyfriend was threatening your life. And regardless of, I'm not just going to count up the number of ounces in your pocket. I'm going to look into your heart and your mind and your situation and come up with a solution that might make you a better person, that might save us a bunch of money, and might make our community safer. Judges are completely forbidden from doing that when you have a mandatory minimum that, no matter what the circumstances are, that judge has to rubber stamp the prosecutor's charge and throw somebody away. So I think that's important. I also think it's important, the idea of reentry. When people come home, people should be able, we need to do away with this lifetime felon designation.
Ban the box.
They call it ban the box. People know what that is. But the reality is that you don't have to call somebody the N-word anymore. Just call them a felon. They're going to be treated just like somebody who was called the N-word back in the 1920s or 30s. They're not going to be able to get a job or vote or anything else. That's something you can do something about, and not just on a racial basis, but just on a justice basis, on a fairness basis. Once you've paid your debt to society, why is it that if you did something wrong at 19 years old, when you're 89 years old, you're still considered a felon? You can never get out of the economic prison, the social prison. That's not true in most countries, but it is true here, and that permanent disenfranchisement and stigmatizing is why people sometimes feel they give up. Why should they try? Why should they do anything any different? They're always going to be treated the same bad way. That doesn't help anybody.
And this group of 130 law enforcement that you spoke of earlier, they are calling for reform. They're calling for reentry programs, drug and alcohol, mental health treatment in our communities. It is a great start. And you are so confident, Van Jones. You believe this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reform our broken criminal justice system. Will Senate Bill 2123 get to the Senate floor for a vote?
It will, and President Obama will sign some version of it. But I think we need to try to improve it, because right now what we know, the prosecutors and the other status quo folks are pushing back, and they're trying to weaken the bill in various ways. And you never know, this thing could pass through the Senate, something similar could pass through the House. You get to committee to the reconciliation process, and something much weaker could come out. So we need to increase the call and turn on the heat and the pressure to actually improve this bill. Even if you want this very bill to pass, it won't pass in this form unless there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. That's why we're asking people to sign up at justicereformnow.org and help us with the fight. Mm-hmm. And also that's why, you know, we have to shake off some of the cynicism. You have some people who've been a part of the criminal justice fight for decades, as I have. The first thing I did when I got out of law school was set up a project to deal with police accountability and police misconduct in the Bay Area. The Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, an organization I helped to found almost 20 years ago, has been in the forefront of the fight in California, actually helped to close five youth prisons, and stop them from building a sixth super jail for youth in Oakland. All of that, way before I got to be a well-known person for my environmental advocacy, I was on the front lines with criminal justice advocacy. So many people who have been fighting this fight have gone over the line into a kind of cynicism that just says, look, nothing's ever going to change, and we're just going to kind of keep fighting because we don't know what else to do, but we don't actually believe that things can change. And I think that is something we need to lay down, just put that burden down. The President of the United States went to a prison, came out, praised the prisoners, condemned the prison, and nobody attacked him. And the leader of the House, the highest-ranking Republican in the country, endorsed him that same day. Mm-hmm. And hell didn't freeze over, and the world didn't come to an end. That lets you know that even though those are just gestures give you a signal as to where the country is. The country is moving to a different place. Same with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues. Completely different place 10 years ago, even 4 years ago, than we are right now. And so things can change, and I believe that things will change if we keep up the fight.
We'll be watching as you continue with your wonderful bipartisan work toward criminal justice reform in the United States. I've been speaking with Van Jones, my great privilege and honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. It's my honor, too. Have me back sometime.
I sure will. Thank you. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. You have been listening to a previously recorded interview with Van Jones. Please call Senators Wyden and Merkley and urge them to strengthen and support Senate Bill 2123, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. Join Van Jones' organization at justicereformnow.org. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are changing.
Join Grassroot News as we celebrate the revolutionary music of Fight the Power, Welcome to the Terror Dome, Public Enemy. November 14th from 10 p.m. to midnight, we're going to focus on Public Enemy. Why? Because we should. So join me, let's fight the power as we chronicle and profile Public Enemy. November 14th from 10 to midnight.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for two positions. We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs director. This is a salary full-time position paying $31,400 a year. The full job descriptions and instructions for applying can be found on our website on the homepage on the right-hand side under News from the BOO. That's at kboo.fm. On the homepage, right-hand side, under News from the BOO. Applications are due Friday, November 20th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media.